Hey, welcome to this episode of The Overcomers. My friend Josh Nadeau, is how you say it, is on with me. And man, I'm so bummed we're not doing this live, bro.
Dude, likewise. To be fair, though, you just told me it's like mid-90s.
Yeah, that's true. You might have died here, but we stay inside. Stay inside in Texas.
You got aircon.
We do. And it blows in here. Like my assistant's wearing a hoodie back there. Like it's nice and crisp here. That's right. So Josh and I, man, we've been chatting back and forth on Instagram for a couple of years now. Usually just pictures of cigars, dialogue about books and beauty. And man, let me just say, I have loved watching how the Lord's using you in this season. I think you're a unique mix of brilliant intellect with kind of a creative outlet, output, a way of communicating that intellect that's super unique. And so I find myself wishing I had some of what was on you. And
dude,
so
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
It's too kind. I saw this meme the other day that was like, men get so few compliments that when they get one, they take it to the bank. And I'm taking that one to
the bank. Take it to the bank.
Also, I'll be pretty Canadian and be like, hey, thanks. That's enough. We don't need to gas me up. I do appreciate it, though. I do love the space. I recognize and have come to recognize that there is not a lot of, like in an artist space, so I'm an artist and a writer. There's not like a lot of traditional depth for Christianity in that space. That space is like typically very open, very edgy, very on the fringe. Yeah. Which is great for artists. That's kind of what you want. That's what artists in one sense are supposed to do. And so I do recognize I've carved out a pretty weird space, but then it's been great.
Yeah. It seems it. Here's what I'd love to do. One, I think the thing I'm drawn to most about what you do and how you teach and how you really is tied to the power of beauty and the draw of beauty in the human soul for the good of the human soul and how God has used that, maybe even designed creation in a real way to echo and reveal that. But I would love to hear, like, and I know you've written about this, and we'll talk about the book because I want everybody to buy it. But I'd love just give me a little bit of your story. I guess give our listeners, you grew up super Christian.
Super Christian, born and raised, dude. We did, became a Christian when I was like 6, watched the Jesus movie, tears in my eyes, want to be with that guy. And then when we did family devotions and stuff, family devotions for me was like Louis Burkhoff. It was, we did Grudem systematic theology. So when I was in Sunday school, people were like, hey, we're like learning about loaves and fishes and we're flannel graph on Sundays. And then like Monday morning, we're like, okay, pater is the Greek word for God the Father. And I'm like, okay, pater.
We're going to go through atonement theories and family devotional.
Totally. And then like it like eventually became, we did R.C. Sproul's Table Talk. That was good.
That's good.
And so like I just was born and raised in the church. And then my dad became a pastor when I was 13.
And where's home?
Home. So where they're at is just outside Toronto.
Okay.
So we moved around a bit, but like smaller towns or the countryside outside Toronto. And then my dad became a pastor when I was 13. He was a cop. And so I got it from both sides. My dad told me when I was a kid, he's like, if you rebel, I got men on the street. And if they catch you, I'll get them to bring you here and you'll have hell to pay with me first and then we'll let the law deal with you.
That sounds very Gen X to me. That sounds like my dad.
I'm an elder millennial, I think. And so I'm 36, turn 37 soon. I like that old school thing. I mean, I've got 2 kids right now and I'm not going to cast too many aspersions on different parenting styles. Everyone does what works for them and each of us has to do our best with our kids. But I will say there's like the intimidation and power factor, the difference between when my wife Aislinn is getting our little one in trouble or when I am.
It's different.
Is like, oh dude, it is like
night and day.
I night also, it's hilarious. I remember being that age and just being sure. like, my dad walks out of the room, just being like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Whoa, big dogs here. Yeah. Like, let's pump the brakes. Yeah. Yeah. And so then for me, I mean, like, I kind of matured into my faith. Not into my faith. What ended up happening was through high school, I was like the poster boy. I knew everything. Didn't have a real living relationship with God because I knew all the stuff.
Yeah.
And I just kind of coasted. Things for me when I went to university is where stuff started, like rubber hit the road. And I really wanted to discern. So I had this thing. My undergrad is in physics, and then my master's is in theology. And so during the first 2 years of my physics degree, I was like, okay, I got to figure out if Jesus is raised from the dead. If Jesus is raised from the dead, then I'm pooched. Bible says so, right? If Christ is not raised, eat, drink, be merry tomorrow, you die. If he is, well, you do what he says. So then I came to the conclusion at the end of that first year that, yeah, resurrection, legit, amen. And then second year was like, is the Bible true? Because Jesus can be raised from the dead, but if the Bible's not legit, there's my other way out.
Yeah.
Then I was convinced of those two things. And that's kind of when my faith really matured. But as you know, when your faith matures, the weight of everything and all the promises and all the stuff you were told when you were a kid, that's when things really matter. Like, nothing matters if you're coasting.
Yeah.
And so as I grew up from that, so it would have been 20 at around that time, that's when life started hitting.
And so how does life hit you? Like, punches you in the face, slow kind of, like,
yeah.
Let's talk about how life hit you. So you're still a young guy.
Yeah, young guy.
You're kind of off by yourself at uni. Mm-hmm. And how does that start to happen? How does life start to happen?
Yeah, I think it was mostly just like the slow fade. So when I moved to Toronto to do my master's, it was this moment of like, I'm really alone. I'm separated from everyone. I can carve my own path. I was 22 at the time, single. And just all the stuff about being a young man. And because of the way my mind works, I couldn't settle for platitudes or truisms or little slogans that people were feeding me. And then I recognized if I wanted to fit in at church, there were ways to do it. And one of them was to avoid where I was really at. Okay. It just like wasn't a place where people were either comfortable with it. Maybe I pushed up against the edges too much. And so I'm also a big reader. And so lots of literature framed my conception of stuff, getting to work through the big ideas of life, the big philosophical problems. And I think what ended up happening for me, which is what I think, it's like, this is just a concept I have for most of life, is that there's a silent majority of people in our churches that just felt mediocre, that feel like I felt like all the promises of my Christianity, that I was going to be fulfilled, that I was going to be full of joy, that I was going to have tons of hope, that wasn't coming through. And then I had all these vices, right? So I'm a drinker. I was a drinker. I was an alcoholic. We can get more into that in a little bit. I'm pretty apathetic. Like, when things get tough, I just totally unplug. And I think even our current moment is very cynical. And so there's all these, like, they're not big sins. They're not even like Jerry Bridges respectable sins. They're just like meh. They're yeah. just like the mediocrity of like a 5 out of 10 life. And I think that's most people. And when you coast at 5 out of 10 for a long time, it gets rough. And then for me, because I was the poster boy, I was involved in everything. So when I was at seminary, I was working full time. I was doing seminary full time. I was teaching at church, leading in small groups, discipling a bunch of guys. And so then I was going through like these cycles of burnout. And a lot of those things I was doing was either trying to prove to myself that my Christianity was something worth having, or that it made sense, that maybe if I could teach it to other people, I could teach it to myself, that I could somehow figure it out. I couldn't. And so I just like kept coping the way that I knew how, which was drinking a ton. Okay.
And so how long does that season last? How long are we?
It's probably like 5 years.
Okay.
Yeah, it's probably like 5 years. And the best way of framing it for people who don't know me, which will be most people on here, and to speak to the people who are just like normal like me, is like, it's often not one big thing you do that sets your life on a horrible course. It's like a billion small choices. It's like the 10 choices you make every day of being apathetic and cynical, of, for me, having a drink to take the edge off, for whatever your coping, insert coping mechanism here, right? Insert way you get by here. It can be porn, it can be gambling, it can be doom scrolling, Netflix, anything. It could be working out, whatever. And so that to me, so there's this ancient conception of the faith that every choice you make, every decision, every aspect of your life is either like an invitation upwards or a descent downwards. And for me, I just kept making the wrong decisions, not necessarily the worst decisions, but I just kept decreating myself.
Yeah.
Until eventually, I remember I was looking through a journal when I was writing the book. And I remember writing, like, I just, that in the world but not of, I feel it, but I don't feel it like a Christian feels it. I feel like a shell of a man. I feel like I'm a ghost haunting my city. Like I'm a coyote, like carving through the shadows, being like, I don't belong here. And I think that's most people.
Yeah.
I think that there's that mediocre in-between space of slow decreation. And we wonder, like, how did I end up here at the bottom?
Most Christians I know, they have this deep longing to understand the Bible more deeply and in ways that move their souls, like to greater worship and gladness. In fact, I feel like I'm in those conversations all the time when it comes to the Bible, like men and women who love God, they go to church. Most of them even start the day by reading their Bible, and yet they still have this hunger to know God's word more deeply in its context and meaning and in a way that really is transforming their lives. And that's why I'm excited to tell you about Kava. It comes from the Hebrew word Kava, which means to wait on or to hope in the Lord. Kava is a Christian streaming platform that really was built to help you understand the Bible and live out your faith with confidence. Think of it as digital discipleship in your pocket. It has Bible studies, documentaries, and there are these conversations led by trusted teachers that help scripture finally come alive in your everyday life. And another reason why this is one of those I really love is that Kava is a nonprofit subscriber-funded ministry, which means when you subscribe, you're not just getting the benefit, but you're partnering with them in creating biblical content that helps people all over the world go deeper in their faith. So this is one of those, like Kava gives you the opportunity to grow with thousands of others who are finding greater confidence in God's word. So you can visit kava.tv/theovercomer. That's kava.tv/theovercomers. And use code OVERCOMER50 for 50% off your first 6 months. Again, that's kava.tv/theovercomers, code OVERCOMER50. So that's a 5-year descent, or you called it decreating, which is great language. What then ultimately jostles you out of that, or at least makes you aware of, oh my gosh, this is where I am?
Totally. So I am newly married. So I'm like 26 or 27, and I'm having a double of bourbon before work in the morning. At this time, I'm working at a big bank in Toronto, and right at Yonge and Dundas, which is like our knockoff of Times Square.
Okay.
So it's 5 in the morning. I've been awake for an hour. I'm just looking out. I'm leaning on the counter. I've got the stovetop light on. So it's that gross pale, like sure. Fluorescent, drains all the life from your body. And I'm looking at the double of bourbon and I knock it back just like I had a million times. And I like my wife was sleeping. So I just give a little salute to the door and head off to cycle into work just like I had a million times before. And as I'm going in, I just keep having this thought, like I had many times before, that some subway car would derail or like a car tire would blow and just hit me and do the deed I'm too afraid to commit. And my nausea that normally accompanied a stiff morning drink felt more like repulsion. And as I'm feeling just this weight of like, dude, it'd be so easy. Like you could just not be here. you could take the big sleep. That would be the way to like quiet all the turmoil inside of you. So I call this rock bottom. This is like my complete rock bottom moment. I just feel like this ache in my chest, this longing, this desire for something, this like echo. And I call it now, looking back, the hidden music. It was just like this thing that was calling out to me. And I had this moment where it wasn't like this massive epiphany, like, oh my gosh, I'm a Christian again and everything's going to make sense. What ended up happening was, it was like, okay, Josh, like if you're okay to take yourself out or to wish you were gone, you can give this one last go, not according to anyone else's standards, but like you figure it out the way that you need to figure it out. So that was the pivotal initial moment.
And so what does it look like then to, gosh, to me, it sounds, just knowing what I know, sounds so complex to, you know, be doing family devotionals with a systematic theology book. And that book in particular is a very, like, it's a reformed, charismatic, yeah, complementarian. It is a fairly, I don't want to call it conservative, I don't think that's fair, but that's your background.
Totally.
You kind of have the facts. They're not facts on fire, right? They're just facts. You hit rock bottom, you hear the song. Now, how do you start to both untangle and weave at the same time?
Totally. And that's the hard part, is I have this whole language and framework that clearly was not working for me. So I remember thinking to myself, listen, this could be 100% true, but if it's not changing my life, how true can it be? Right? And either the problem's the truth I'm believing or the problem's me, and I'm okay to figure out which one it is.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know what the next right step was, because I knew what everyone had told me to do, and I'd done it a bajillion times. Take two verses, call me in the morning, right? And I was like, okay, like platitudes, put them into a six shooter. Yeah, I mean, you're in Texas, you know, a revolver, put some platitudes in, boom.
Even though we tend to use more semi-autos now here in Texas than the revolvers.
Take me back, man. Yeah. Take me back to the good old days, to the Yosemite Sam days. Yeah, so I didn't know what to do theologically, but because I'd read so many books, the idea was I'd seen the hero's journey before, right? All my heroes, all the people in every book, they all face this crisis and they said, okay, fine, I just have to take the next right step. I don't know where I'm going, I don't know how I'm going to get there, but I can just take the next right step. And so all I did was do my best to take the next right step. And for me, initially, that looked like quitting my job. I'm not telling people to quit their jobs. It was just, hey, I need to probably stop drinking. I can't keep drinking as a coping mechanism to the pain going on in my life. I'm either going to have to feel it and heal it or cope all the way. And I don't want to cope all the way. And so I quit my job. I picked up a gig as a delivery guy, a food delivery guy on my bicycle. And so many mini revelations of like who I really was. So I'm delivering food through the city and you just meet people just as lost and just as broken as you. The lady opens the door, she's smoking a cigarette, she just wants her Chinese food. She looks just as empty and destitute as I am. And then you meet someone else and like a high rise and they're living the dream and they ask you how long you've been doing this. And the first thing out of my mouth was like, hey, I used to be a project manager, just started doing this. And I'm like, oh, okay, Josh, like what kind of insecurity do you feel and identity crisis are you having that this person you will never see again needs to know that you are not a delivery guy? Yeah. What's wrong with being a delivery guy? And so I was like, okay, I think, Josh, like the first thing is an identity problem. You haven't, like, who are you really down at your core? And so then it was just the continued unweaving of all the things that I had assumed and all the hiccups along the way, right? So people at church heard about it and asked me to go out for drinks and for beers and told me that the reason why my marriage is rough and having a crisis of faith is because I'm not praying enough or not leading enough or not doing the stuff enough. I remember telling the guy, I'm like, listen, I don't know if you're right. I just know it wasn't working. And maybe you're more right than I am, because like you're not drunk at 5 a.m. before work. But this is clearly not working for me. And so what I wanted to find, what I needed to find, was something that could bear up under my infinite need. Alcohol couldn't do it. Platitudes couldn't do it. Hypocrisy couldn't do it. Playing the part couldn't do it. So I had this infinite need, and what I wanted was something that could bear up against it.
Yeah. And then tell me about your girl in all of this. You've got a wife who married. Now, was she aware of kind of the duplicitous nature of what was going on in you before marriage, or did she marry super Christian and then go, oh crap, you know, 10 minutes in?
Probably a bit of both. Okay. I didn't know too much about myself. So this was a time like before like mental health was a thing dudes talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Or anyone talked about. And so she knew a little bit, like she knew I was a drinker. And I just think she would have never even assumed it was alcoholism.
Yeah.
She knew I had questions, but I'm like having deep philosophical questions. And she's like, yeah, okay, let's go do our thing. And I did for the most part until like these rock bottom moments, like I just towed the line. So one of the things that I recognized in myself was this idea that as a man and as a Christian and with my, say, particular set of giftings or direction in life, that I should just be able to bear up any load. That's like my value and my worth is like, listen, Josh, you can sleep 4 hours a night, 5 hours a night. You can date your wife. You can go to school full time. You can work full time. You can do all the stuff. And if/when you fall apart, that's a weakness in you. So let's get that together. And so I think as things started falling apart, things started coming apart at the seams, she realized it. And I'm very blessed. She's amazing. She was just along for the ride. She was, I say often, like echoes of that hidden music, right? She's like the visible, tangible expression of Christ singing over me, of someone with me the whole way through. And then you'll resonate with this too, was like, I got into boxing. I did martial arts a ton growing up, but boxing was one of those things where for me, it was just at first is a place where I was like, hey, I've done this before. I need a place to clear my mind, start thinking. I just don't need to think. I don't need to solve all the problems. So going to the boxing gym just became a framework of understanding what life could be like. And I'll explain. I walk into the gym, and as I'm sure you felt this day one going into the jiu-jitsu gym, and you're just like, I'm top dog other places. I'm bottom rung here.
It maybe even lower.
Yeah, dude, I'm dog food. Yeah. So then I have this thing where I refuse to go to a state-of-the-art gym. And so I found a rough gym on the rough side of town. The girl behind the desk, she was smoking when I walked in. And it was like bloodstains.
Nothing says fitness. Like,
yeah, totally, right?
Smoking this is like, in the lobby.
This was not mama's like boxer size class. This was like blood on the mat, old leather, chain, smelled like tin. I was like, okay, this is the spot. And then when I went back that night to train, I was like, oh, these are the people who come to this spot. And I am not one of them.
Yeah.
And so I had this moment of like, hey, I know what this is like, right? I can either fake it and do what I did at church. I can leave. No one knows me here. I can't leave church the same way. Or I can just kind of come in as I am. And I was like, fine, I'll just go in as I am. And there are these moments where you just like through your body, feel your weakness and work with people who train you up in the way you need to go. So eventually I'm there for months, feel your body get stronger. You know, your body's getting stronger. You're sweating less. You can do more pushups. You're doing more skipping. When it comes time to sparring, you're getting clipped less, right? I'm not going home with split lips and a bloody nose every night. I'm going home and I gave someone the split lip and the bloody nose. You're like, okay, I'm getting it. And the reason is coach stays with you after class and he says, you want to know why you keep getting clipped? Because your shoulders, like your hands keep dropping. Your shoulders are weak. Let's get your shoulders strong. Want to know why you can't dodge that or slip this? It's foot placement. It's everything. And I remember one night I'm cycling home. And I just have this thought to myself. I was like, how come we don't do discipleship like this? How come we don't let it be this deeply embodied thing where my body reveals my weakness, where someone is living life with me up close and they're paying attention to the things that are catching me. And they're saying, listen, here's how you fight back. Here's how you defend. Here's how you get stronger. And so that began to give me this framework of embodiment that I think was the thing that was missing. So then after I go with beers for that guy and he condemns me for not doing these spiritual rhythms and spiritual practices, I'm just like reflecting on my life and trying to put all these pieces together. And I remember a time when when I'm doing my master's, we have to write these papers. I'm writing a hermeneutical paper on Moses' song or something. And at the library at the school I went to, there is this special seats for master's students. So you could sit there, no normie bachelor degree Come people on. Could take it for you. And so we're there late one night. It was a small school. The librarian gave us a key and he's like, stay as late as you guys want, lock up when you're done. So it's like 8 o'clock at night and I start getting hungry. And so I say to him, I'm like, dude, you hungry? Do you want to go get something to eat? And he asks me, hey, are you hungry? And I say, oh yeah, like I can get up out of the Hebrew and get into another kind of brew. And he says to me, after like laying this foundation, oh dude, I'm not actually hungry. I'm just feasting on this passage. And I was like, okay, so cool. I'm going to go get a burger and some beer. Like, what did you need to piety signal to me? And I remember putting all these pieces together, just saying to myself, I think the world that I'm living in is functionally Gnostic. We live in a place where like the body doesn't matter. Your body is going to lie to you. Your emotions are going to lie to you. Everything, all the cravings of your body and urgings of your body. Your body's just the machine to carry your soul and brain around. If you want to heal yourself, you need the secret knowledge, which is like the Gnostic idea of Gnosis, the secret that's going to save you. The material is just a prison. One day when you go to heaven, you're just a disembodied dude floating in the clouds. And I was like, oh, I don't think anyone would call themselves a Gnostic, but functionally, this is how we deal with everything, right? We want to talk about like, hey, I desire God, but the only ways I do it are like prayer. And there's nothing wrong with prayer, as long as you can root it in the body and through the body and learn that. It needs substance, it needs flesh, it needs incarnation. And so for me, this opened up completely new avenues to explore what it meant for me to be a Christian, what it meant for me to like, not just live a life of prayer, but to incarnate prayer, what it meant to live a life of virtue, but incarnate virtue, like virtue in the flesh, not just virtue in the spirit or in my brain.
Yeah.
I'm currently rereading The Way of the Pilgrim. And one of the things that the book opens up with is just this concept of constant prayer and how we do it and how we think it's an answer when we can give all these theological definitions to it. But what we really need to do is live inside the life of prayer. You need to embody the life of prayer. And so that was huge for me, the embodiment issue.
Yeah. And then, so did that take you, if I'm thinking kind of embodied theology, does that take you Eastern Orthodox, Catholic?
Yeah.
Listen, I'm a happy Reformed guy, but I'm also painfully aware of some of the things that Reformation cost us in regards to beauty and in regards to some of the things you're talking about now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when I was in seminary, I went to a Reformed Baptist seminary, and I'm neither of those things now, as I'm sure the icon of Jesus gives away right there. I remember stumbling across a bunch of Roman Catholic thinkers and Eastern Orthodox thinkers. And this comes later on in the story, but like I'm starting to ask the questions. And then a couple years down the road, my wife and I are living in Spain. And we can get there when we get there. And I remember stumbling across John Paul II's Theology of the Body, which is like a 700-page tome. And the kicker in there is that the body reveals the soul. Your visible body reveals invisible realities. It's why Christ is incarnate. It's why he says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Christ is a visible representation of God the Father. If you've seen him, you've seen the Father. And so I then could look at my body. When I was going through all this stuff, I could look at my body, all the cravings of my body, all the desires of my body, and I could see who I really was, right? What am I craving? If I'm craving the good, awesome. If my body has a deep desire for some vice, right? So like when I wanted to numb with alcohol, my body's telling me I need healing, right? Something's broken, Josh. You don't know what it is. You are looking for healing, for satisfaction. And there are reasons for all those things. For me, it was not understanding the love of God. And we can get into that a ton. My body revealed it. Now, I numbed it. I disparaged my body. So one of the things that the Gnostics did, there's two options. You're either a hedonist if you're a Gnostic, because like, who gives a shit about the body, right? It's immaterial. It's garbage anyways. Eat, drink, be merry. Tomorrow you die. Or you're this ascetic where like you just torture your body. And I think I tended between both. And I know that our culture is like an example of both. How many people do we know be like, hey, I don't care about my body. No one taught me to value my body. So I will indulge every selfish passion I have. And then we also live in a culture where it's like, hey, the body's the only thing I got. If I can't show it off on Instagram, on TikTok, on socials, if I can't take these drugs, if I can't wear these booty shorts, whatever it is, I got nothing. I have zero identity. And so my body, all these things just became a signpost for who I really was. And I started listening to my body. I started saying like, okay, Josh, when you feel these things, when you want these things, when your body is feeling like panic, tight, scared, whatever, broken, alone, when you feel disconnected from the world, like, why do you think you feel empty? Maybe you are empty.
Yeah.
And what does it mean to be full? And don't just settle for a platitude. Like, you know that the platitudes weren't filling you up. So find something that's going to fill you up or else you don't make it. So the embodiment problem for me was just like this complete framework and finding John Paul II. And then part of it was just like I said earlier, like, listen, I was close to calling it quits. And for me, I just wanted to have the courage to say, I'll give this one last shot. And so be like, listen, everyone in the world around me, the world I was in was like, listen, don't listen to your body. Your body's really bad. And I'll be like, listen, I tried doing it that way. I'm going to listen to it for a year, 2 years, 3 years. And like, it worked out. Really well, to be honest. And like, I know that rejecting this idea of like body bad, soul good, the solutions to all of our problems are these like esoteric, disembodied spiritual platitudes is never going to help us get through life. We need flesh and blood.
How could you, like somebody who's listening, that these are like brand new concepts? Mm-hmm. What are kind of baby steps to listening to the body as it reveals the soul, as mm-hmm. John Paul II?
Yeah, rightly said. The dude's a genius.
Yeah.
The first one is, and not to gas myself up, read my book. And I mean that in the sense of like, I wrote it as like a catechism for the disenchanted. I wrote it with the mindset that, hey, this is going to be new territory for a ton of people. And I didn't write it as a theological tome. I wrote it as a story.
Yeah.
I wrote it as a story because of the beauty thing. And we can chat about that more too. I wrote it in such a way that like, I can take you through the embodied journey of asking the questions, of putting language around the things your body has felt for years and just helping you go through it. Again, not to gas myself up. I'm not this guy. One of the things that I've had to learn to process is getting these really kind messages from people about reading the book. And the one that means the most to me, other than stuff about craft, because I love writing and it's my favorite thing to do, is people saying like, hey, you put language around stuff that I haven't or maybe could never put language around. And so that's the first one. My book is literally the introduction and it will take you through Room for Good Things to Run Wild. The second thing is like just baby steps, right? Like you don't need to listen to your body all the time. You don't know if you can trust your body yet.
Yeah.
And you don't know if you have like enough virtue to discern what your body wants, right? So like you can feel this like primal craving. Like say, for example, before we were chatting about stag's head up on the wall, you can have a primal craving. You can orient it towards the good of stewarding God's creation well and feeding your family and taking, or you can like kill someone in the street. That's primal.
Yeah.
One is good as one, and one is not. And so virtue becomes, so for me, virtue became, I really needed to discern what it looked like for the virtues to be embodied. And so I just decided that, hey, there are the theological virtues. I was like, hey, we're just going to use those. So any moment you ever have where you're not sure what you should do, are you being chased? No, then figure out why your body's craving that lust instead of chastity. Figure out why your body is craving wrath and anger instead of love and joy and peace and patience. You're feeling greedy? Why greedy instead of benevolent and generous? Like, your body can become a signpost if you have the internal fortitude to say, like, hey, listen, I will measure this up against a rock solid virtue. So in Rome, you have like these levels of spirituality. And I'm not Catholic, by the way, but I've read a lot of Roman Catholics just in case. I don't, whatever. So in these levels, and people can agree with them or not agree with them, it doesn't matter, but it just goes to show the reality of what the spiritual and virtuous life looks like, is like putting sin to death. Take John Owen and like the mortification of sin. That's step one. Vivification of the virtues is like step two. And like they have seven steps of what it looks like to be an exemplar of the virtuous life and be in union with Christ. And so they have five more. And then for me, this idea of like, hey, the purpose of life is to become a saint. Then if that's the path I'm on, then every opportunity is this invitation. And like, Josh, you just like, you have to get past it. So when Paul says like, you beat your body and make it your slave, he's saying you beat your body and align it with ultimate goodness and virtue. And then guess what? Your body loves virtue, and every craving you have, that's what heaven will be. That's like what the resurrection of the body will be like. Is your every longing will be fully oriented towards truth and goodness and beauty. And so I was like, well, that's what I'm supposed to do now. And so these things became gateways. Now, like, I didn't start off well. Like, I got blackout drunk after deciding to become a saint. I made all kinds of mistakes. Like, the rumors of my life were greatly exaggerated. But I was on the path, and I knew that's what mattered.
That's great. I love that idea of like being on the path. I just think after 30 years in ministry and 23 pastoring the same group of people, basically, that metaphor, and really that whole kind of pilgrim's progress idea of what faith looks like, where, man, sometimes you get trapped in the dungeon and you get lost in the forest, and sometimes you know you should have walked through this gate and you didn't walk through this gate and now you're stuck, and that there's so much grace available that if you think sanctification is up and to the right, you're never going to let yourself experience or receive from God. But if you understand, like, I'm on the path, I'm on the long journey home, and this journey is fraught with dragons and dungeons and sorrows and victories and beauty and death, and yeah. and Jesus knew what he was buying on the cross. He knew what he was purchasing. He's not looking at me now and wanting a mulligan. I think that Romans 5, how much more? Like, how much more? You know, that I love Romans 5. I mean, he's just such a beautiful Pauline way to say, nobody was good, and yet that's when he died for you. How much more now that you're his adopted son, adopted daughter, does he love you than when he first adopted you while you were at your worst? Like, I love that passage. I wish I could just infuse it into the soul of people who feel stuck or who are stuck checking boxes without the connection. And man, I've got some of my own story in there where kind of the big lie in my soul's always been, I'm useful, not necessarily lovable. And so this whole idea was good for me, like really medicine for my soul, because my concept of God was, if I'm performing, then we're good. If I'm performing for God, then I'm good. But if I'm not being useful, then there's not much of me that's lovable or wanted. And man, that you know, Paul's like, hey, don't return to slavery. Don't go back there. That's not true. And so the journey, I've always been drawn to the idea of long journey home, being on the path. Mm-hmm. That's the safe place. Not doing great, being on the path. If I'm measuring the journey with highs and lows, I'm gonna not be doing well in certain seasons and be doing not as well as I think I'm doing in others. Totally. And so love that analogy.
Yeah, I struggle a lot with the same thing. I like the wilderness for me is how I always frame it, and like the wilderness is dangerous. I had this big thing like, hey, yeah, like Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so, but like I didn't believe it, I didn't feel it, and I wanted to believe it and feel it, and I knew that experiencing the love of God was like the way. And that whole idea of usefulness, man, do I feel that? Man, did I, like, that was a different time in my life. And it was a dark time in my life. And I know, like, again, just to reiterate to people, the platitude and the idea of telling yourself that, yeah, Jesus loves me, this I know, because the Bible tells me so, is only going to get you so far. And the reason why, like, sanctification is just like this winding journey, this like wandering in the wilderness, is because like you have a lot of stuff inside of you to figure out why you can't enjoy and embrace and be loved by God.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so there's that Henry Nouwen thing of like, hey, the whole part of my life was not to go find God, but to realize he's been looking for me. Not to go love God, but to realize he's been loving me. And I have all this sin and rebellion and selfishness that keeps me from going, like trusting, believing. And so the path into love for me was a big one. It was a heavy one. But I agree with you, like it's so easy. And like the reminder that Paul gives is like, don't go back to lovelessness. Yeah. When he says like, don't be like burdened again by that yoke of slavery, he's saying like, don't go back to a loveless life. Yeah. Don't go back to the broken cisterns that hold no water. Don't go back to mud pies on the shore when adventure at sea is available to you, like Lewis says. But we're so quick to be like, yeah, I could be in control.
Yeah.
I could get the love of God from the bottom of this bottle. I'm sure of it. It'll work this time.
Yeah. We are foolish creatures, as Lewis would so aptly put it. So talk a little about, I mean, you're sharing some of your stories, all of it's in the book. The book's exceptional, both technical and like in regards to beauty in writing. Found the story compelling. It was like just well done. And so talk a little bit about kind of your hope for that book and the lives of people, and kind of your own angst behind it. And this is kind of unique because we don't really do, like, I'm not usually having guys on to talk about their book, which isn't really what we've done, but I want you to talk about the book because I think it's people should read it.
The impetus of the book was like, beauty will save the world. And so I think that beauty is the apologetic for the modern time. It was not truth claims that convinced me. I mean, I grew up super Christian, catechized at a very young age. It was beauty that brought me back. It was beauty. It was the beauty of God that sang the song over me. And it was a song that I had to find the tune to. And so what I wanted to do with the book was just say, hey, beauty's the apologetic. I'm going to give every ounce of truth I possibly can, not through the framework of a lecture, of a systematic theology, of any theological tome, but through the most beautiful story I can tell, which is just God's work in my life. And I'm going to do my best to master my craft, to say it as best as I can, and use the art that I do that as best as I can. And so Peter Kraft, he's a Catholic philosopher. He has this idea of, so there's this idea of the transcendentals, truth, goodness, and beauty, and that God is the source of these things. So all truth is God's truth, all goodness is God's goodness, all beauty is God's beauty, and these things exist insofar as they find their source in God. Now, that's like the ontological way of talking about it. So being, God's being, leads to truth, truth leads to goodness, and goodness expresses virtue. But there's this psychological expression of those things, which is what you and I experienced, and this embodied experience of, which is like, listen, if I look at you, I don't think to myself, oh man, what a great ontological being. I'm like, hey, what a handsome cat. I like hanging out with Matt. I like telling stories. I like laughing. I like being, I like the beauty I'm experiencing in him and through him. And I was like, well, hey, like God does that for me every day. I get sunrise every day. I get flowers. I get the mountains. I get my wife. I get my kids. I get everything. And so what happened to me in my life was just saying like, what if beauty was God's apologetic? Right? Like, what if this was God reaching out to me? And what if I just said, fine, I'm going to go as deep into beauty as I possibly can. I'm going to get drowned by it. And then that led to virtue. And then that led to truth. And truth led me home. Come on, man. So like, I just wanted to write the book. I know you're a pastor. You know this. You have the people who are at the bottom, who are bottoming it out. They're deconstructing. They're on the fringe. The people at the top, whether at the top for real or they're hypocritical, those are two slivers of people. 5% here, 5% here, maybe 10 on each side. I think you got 80 to 90% of people in the middle who are just struggling and no one's speaking their language. When I say no one, I mean, I'm sure there are people, but by and large, no one is speaking their language. No one is talking to them. We're having cultural conversations. We're having the culture wars. We're having everything we're supposed to be having except for like, hey, like what about the dude who's just like a 4 out of 10 life? Who's like, hey, like, my mom died and I'm not cheating on my wife and I'm not drinking myself comatose, but like I'm coping by playing video games all day and I'm not spending time with my kids and I'm not spending time with the Lord and I'm not doing all these things. And like, what is that doing to me? And so I just pictured as many people as I could who are on the fringe, who are being hypocrites, who are in this mediocre space. And I said, what if I had one chance to just bring them back?
Yeah.
And I think beauty is the way to do it. I think like, hey, like you could conceive of the most beautiful life. And I think the most beautiful life, and I think I did my best about saying becoming a saint is the most beautiful life you can live. You got one shot. It'll be the hardest thing you ever do. Brutal. Becoming a saint, brutal. But it is so good.
Worth it.
And it'll change everything. So that's why I wrote it. It's just like the normal person, dude. Like I can't shake. My dad's a pastor. He's just a normal guy. No one's ever going to know his name, right? I mean, I could tell people now, but you'll forget it by the mid-afternoon. And he's just like, he works 80-hour weeks and he meets with people whose like dogs died or kids quit or like daughters committed suicide or whatever it is. He's at hot. You know what it's like being a pastor. There's so many unseen things. It'd be like, that's the life I want to talk to. The unseen things that you do, Matt, the unseen things these people go through and this way of like, how do I conceive of a life where the promises of God get me through those? You know what I mean? Where like my friend's dad, when I remember being in high school, my friend's dad died on a motorcycle accident. And by the end of the week, everyone back to making fun of him. And you're like, what the hell are we doing?
Yeah.
And be like, what if God's truth could bear up underneath everything and make it worth it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, bro. That's
a revolution,
the book.
Dude.
It is. Yeah, it can be. It can be. So yeah, if you're listening to this podcast, and my guess is like you got a little bit of that in you. If you're listening to this podcast, I mean, what we're talking about usually is overcoming these things, not wanting to be a 4 or 5 if abundant life is offered to us. And so not easy life, but real life. And so, man, I commend the book to you and, man, commend Josh's art. And he's a great follow on the gram. And unless he's fasting from it or,
coming
soon. Great Substack. And so, again, I'm not trying to be Flavor Flav to his Chuck D, but, that was my time, boss. That was my time. So, man, thank you for joining me, man. I was looking forward to this one day, face-to-face stories, background, best cigars possible. We'll go from there. So thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Overcomers. God bless. And we'll see you next time. Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning in to The Overcomers. I just pray your heart is always encouraged in the Lord. Really, the ministry I feel God's called me to in this season is to be one that's encouraging you, telling you the Lord sees you, reminding you of the opportunities that we have as the people of God in this day. And so The Overcomers podcast is one of the ways I do that. Another way is that I'm sending out a monthly newsletter. And in that, I've got a little audio link for kind of things I'm thinking about and wrestling through that I'm not necessarily preaching on. And so in the show notes is a link where you can go and sign up for that monthly email. And so, man, if The Overcomers is encouraging you, I would encourage you then to click on that link, sign up for the newsletter. And it's a way for me to further encourage you as you seek to live as overcomers in this current moment. Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning in to The Overcomers. I just pray your heart is always encouraged in the Lord. Really, the ministry I feel God's called me to in this season is to be one that's encouraging you, telling you the Lord sees you, reminding you of the opportunities that we have as the people of God in this day. And so The Overcomers podcast is one of the ways I do that. Another way is that I'm sending out a monthly newsletter. And in that, I've got a little audio link for kind of things I'm thinking about and wrestling through that I'm not necessarily preaching on. And so in the show notes is a link where you can go and sign up for that monthly email. And so, man, if The Overcomers is encouraging you, I would encourage you then to click on that link, sign up for the newsletter. And it's a way for me to further encourage you as you seek to live as overcomers in this current moment.